Hello and welcome to Minbar. I'm your host, Ahmed Hanif. And on this edition of Minbar, we are joined with Dr. William Chittick, professor of religion at the State University of New York. We are here to discuss his life, get glimpses into his life, and talk about his work, his interests, and the role of Irfan in Islam. Dr. Chittick, welcome to Minbar.
Thank you very much.
First of all, I heard that you studied here in Iran. And you left around 1979 after being here for some 12 years or so.
That's correct.
That would put you at what, around 26 or so when you came?
When I came I was 22.
22?
Yes.
Now, 22 would put us into the 60s, late 60s or
so,
right?
That's right.
Now, at that time, there were a lot of, like, Americans and so on, leaving America and so on, traveling into the Middle East. Looking for spiritual enlightenment and so on. Were you part of that trend?
Well,
what brought you to Iran?
No, not really. I mean, I met some of those people. Those people, when they arrived in Iran, they were usually on the way to Afghanistan, where the hashish was very cheap, and India, where the gurus basically let you do what you wanted. Some of them I met, a very good friend, I met on the way back from India. And he decided he liked Iran. He had gone through about 2 years of being a student of an esoteric master of Hinduism. He had become extremely sick and weak and wasted, and so he had to stop in Iran to recuperate. And we used to he stayed for 3 or 4 years, and we used to joke with him that he's half Iranian, because in fact his weight doubled while he was here, and he became stabilized and got interested in Irfan himself. But myself, you see, I was, my interest was always basically academic, in the sense that my first acquaintance with Sufism was through writings and books at a university level, and the reason I became acquainted was because I spent a year at the American University of Beirut. Mm-hmm. And the reason I was in Beirut is because I was tired of Ohio, which you've been in America long enough to understand how that might happen. It was a bit drab and dull. It was a good university, but I want a little bit of excitement. I read in Time magazine that the American University of Beirut has a beautiful private beach on the Mediterranean. You know, that called to me.
Right.
And so that was basically the reason I went. Just to get away from Ohio and get to the beach.
So you were in Islamic studies before you came?
No, I wasn't. Uh-huh. I was in history.
Uh-huh.
But since once I arrived in Beirut at the American University, I saw no reason to continue my American history and European history. Okay, we'll take courses on Islamic history, which I did. And I also had to write an independent project for my junior year. And I went through the history books and found one chapter which sort of caught my imagination, and that was called Sufism.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying Sufism at that point. And then, of course, the really important thing about that year is that Sayyid Hossein Nasser was a visiting Aga Khan professor of Islamic studies
at the American
AUB,
University.
Yes, uh-huh. In that year, and he gave a series of public lectures on Islam, the first part of which were shortly after, a couple of years later, were published as Ideals and Realities of Islam.
Oh, that's a very, very interesting book.
Yes, it is.
It's very accessible.
And I had, by the time he started those lectures, I was already getting quite familiar with Sufism, according to the Orientalists.
Right.
And his fourth lecture, I think, was on Sufism. And I said, well, I might as well go to all of the lectures, because get a sense of this guy, whoever he is. And I thought, he's a great speaker, really captivating, and as I found him very, very inspiring. And then once we got to the Sufism section, which I'd been studying for 3 months and I considered myself an expert on,
mm-hmm.
I didn't know what he was talking about. I said, what? I didn't hear any of those things in these books I've been reading.
Right. You're reading from the Orientalist point of view.
Exactly. Uh-huh. It was totally Orientalist point of view. So I went and found Nasser's books. Three Muslim Sages was the one that was available.
Right.
If you remember, that's, I think it's Ikhwan al-Safas, or maybe it's Ibn Sina.
Ibn Sina
sort of already in Ibn Arabi.
Right.
The Ibn Arabi section really caught me.
Uh-huh.
So I said, maybe I should follow up on this. So that was the beginning.
And
then at the end of the year, I told Dr. Nasser, I'd like to continue on with these studies at work. And I did. I said, well, come to Iran, no problem. You know, there's a program for foreign students. At that time, they had an excellent program in Persian literature, PhD program, mm-hmm. in Persian literature for foreign students. Mm-hmm. So it began very slowly.
I see.
By the end of the third year, we were up on the same level with the Iranian
That's
students.
Very interesting, because one of my questions was, how did you move from studying Persian literature
yes.
to Ibn Arabi
right.
and Arabic and so
right.
forth, you know?
Right. Well, that was very easy, and it was a necessity of my studies. In fact, I didn't come here to study Persian literature. I came here to study Sufism.
I see.
Right? And the one vehicle that offered a program that would prepare you for such studies academically was this PhD program in Persian literature, because in order to study Sufism in this country, obviously you have to be fluent in Persian,
right.
you have to be able to read the classical text, you have to be able to read Masnavi and books like this. I went to Dr. Nasser, maybe it was in the third year or so, once I had, was about to finish the courses, and asked him about, PhD dissertation, and he said, well, why don't you edit Naqd al-Nusus Sharh Naqsh al-Fusus of Abdurrahman Jami. And I said, well, what's that? And he said, well, Ibn Arabi wrote a little book called Naqsh al-Fusus, that is the imprint of the bezels or the
right.
ring stones, in which he summarizes the Fusus al-Hikam in
right.
like 10 pages.
Uh-huh.
Right? And Jami, the great poet and Sufi teacher who died in 1492, Jami wrote a long commentary on this in Persian.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had been studying Arabic, of course, along because really in classical Persian literature.
While you were in Iran, or did you start in?
I started in Beirut. I had a year of Arabic before.
Okay.
Yes. But in Iran, I continued with Arabic mm-hmm. because it's necessary. I mean, how are you going to read the Quran if you don't?
Right.
That's the basis of Islamic studies. It's the basis of Sufism. So, when I looked at Jami's Persian work, it turned out that 2/3 of it is in Arabic. It's one of these books. Patchwork,
right,
which goes back from Arabic and Persian, Arabic and Persian, it was the introduction, it was all Persian, beautiful Persian. And then he starts quoting from various authors, he just quotes, that's
yes.
it, long text in Arabic.
Right.
So in order to read the book, you had to be very proficient in Arabic. A lot of the quotations were from Ibn Arabi, who's difficult enough, Sadruddin Ghunavi, his most important disciple, who's even more difficult than his sheikh in terms of his Arabic prose, and other members, famous members of the school, most of them commentators on the Fusus al-Hikam.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there were quotations there from Kalam works and works on philosophy. So one of the things I set out to do, and I succeeded in doing, was to track down his sources.
Right.
And that took a lot of work. Part of it involved poring over manuscripts, because although most of these books are now published, over the past 35 years, many of the books that weren't published then have been published. At that time, my only access was through manuscripts, either in Tehran University Library and also in Istanbul. I spent a good deal of time in Istanbul.
So you moved from here to Istanbul?
I didn't move. Oh. I just, when I went to America to visit my parents, I would stop for 10 days on the way back and, look up the books that I needed to see, this sort of thing.
But in some of your early stuff, you have, for example, the Psalms of Islam,
yes.
which you had written while you were here.
No, not at all. I wrote that several years after I was
okay.
back in America.
And then I understand that you had also met Allama Tabatabai.
That's correct.
And you had a working relationship with him?
Well, you see, that was, the situation was this, that Dr. Nasser, working with an American scholar of religion, really, who wanted to put together a series of works on world religions written by authorities, of each religion.
Right.
A Hindu master would write. They needed a Muslim master.
Mm-hmm.
And consulted Dr. Nasser, he says, well, maybe I can get Allama Tabatabai to write the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was decided he would write two books. The first was translated by Nasser himself, Shi'ism, Shiite Islam, or something, by Tabatabai. The second was the Quran in Islam, again by Tabatabai. So these two books he wrote specifically for
Dr. Nasser.
Yeah, for Dr. Nasser.
Uh-huh.
And the third was an anthology of basic Shiite texts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dr. Nasser was a very busy man. He always has been. And so he looked around at his students to see if anyone could take on the task of translating this anthology. Alim Tabatabai chose a series of hadith, Untohid and prophecy, and, you know, all from the prophet, well, one or two things, mainly from the imams.
Right.
And some prayers, and the famous Ahde Malika Ashtar about justice,
right,
by Imam Ali. He had chosen these, put them in order, you know, in terms of that these should be translated. So
right.
I sat down and, you know, spent a couple of years working in that. So that was my first acquaintance with really solid Shiite text.
Right.
And I was, you know, had to go back and consult with the commentaries and this sort of thing. It was very, very useful for me, and
right,
the, you know, a book came out of it, a Shiite anthology.
So did you actually meet
Yes, I did. Dr. Nasser would often go to visit Tabatabai, but for consultation, or just because they were friends.
Right.
And sometimes he would invite me to come along.
What were your impressions of Alim Tabatabai?
Very impressed. I mean, it's very difficult to describe. He was a great man, there's no doubt. First of all, he's sort of unremarkable in a way. You know, he's very...
Understated.
Understated, extremely, sort of, you know, Ustadeh, as they say in Persian, right? You didn't, you know, if you'd seen him in the street, you wouldn't have noticed, except this, if you look carefully, oh, this man has something special. You know, there was a serenity about him. He was somewhat special, no question about that.
Yeah, I think that's a special type of experience, because many of us have not had that particular beautiful experience.
Yeah.
Now, one of your books is about Mawla Rumi,
right.
Mawlana Rumi. A very famous book, very popular book, The Sufi Path of Love.
Yes.
What is your idea about the role of love in Islamic esotericism? Because, I mean, when we see in the media and things
written
about Islam, we get this impression of Islam as a, you know, a legalistic, dry religion.
Of course, right.
You know, and you're talking about love as a very essential element in Islamic spirituality.
Right. Well, I personally, if I, you know, if I had to, I would say there's no spirituality without love for God. They're almost synonymous. And love for God demands God's love for human beings. It's a mutual thing. It's a sign of God's love. And of course, the basic reference for all discussions of love, certainly in the Sufi tradition, and also among the philosophers, you know, the Quran people are a bit wary of love because they like to insist that God is so transcendent, it's very difficult for them to conceive of how God could love such insignificant beings as human, as us humans. In their mind, his job is to give us instructions, and we have to follow them.
Yeah, you must fear him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Fear is the primary. But, of course, the Sufi tradition takes the other, and sometimes goes to an extreme, and says that love is everything. But look back to the Quranic reference, the basic Quranic reference, which all of this, it's constantly repeated in the Sufi texts, is yuhibbuhum wa yuhibbunahu, right? He loves them, and they love him. Now, this sets up the relationship between the divine and the human, and notice it's mutual.
Right.
God is lover of human beings, and human beings are lovers of God. God is beloved, the beloved of human beings, and human beings are the beloved of God. So both God and human beings are lover and beloved. How does that work out? If God is so transcendent, you see, so this whole issue, now we have to unpack this. And the other verse, which is utterly essential for the Sufi perspective, is in tuhibbun Allah fattabi'uni. Yuhibbukum Allah, right? If you, the words of are given to the Prophet, qul, say, O Muhammad, if you love God, follow me, and God will love you. Now, so, in order to, if you love God, what is the first necessity is to follow the Prophet. So, let's say if you read the Maghalat of Shamsi Tabrizi, which I, you know, translated into English, Shams constantly comes back to the point that the essence of Islam is mutaba'at. That is following. Now, why is the essence of Islam following? Because by following Muhammad, you can express your love for God, and you will receive in turn the love of God.
Right.
God loves those who follow Muhammad. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the other, there's a hadith, which is the constant source of reference also in Sufi texts. I haven't done a statistical study, but from my own experience, you know, for example, from reading Ibn Arabi, I think it's the most common hadith which he cites. He refers to it all the time. And the hadith, I mean, it's very famous, that it's a long hadith, and the part I want to, you know, look at right now is where it's hadith Qudsi, so God is speaking, and he says, if those who seek nearness to me through good works, when they do so, then I love them. Then right. I love them, and when I do love them, then I am. Not I become, I am. Ibn Arabi has a lot to say about why he says I am and not I become. Then I am the eye, the ear with which he hears, the eye with which he sees, the hand with which he holds, and the foot with which he walks. Now, what does this mean? It's a very explicit hadith,
yes,
about coming together with God. As a result of what? Good works. And as a result of loving God, clearly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when, because why do you seek nearness to God? If you love God, follow me, and
right.
God will love you. So
right.
following the Prophet leads to this love of God. So this hadith is just unpacking the implications of
yes.
this. And when you do follow Muhammad, that's what good works are.
Right.
Then God, when he does come to love you, the love that he promises in the Quran, that he states in the Quran, the fruit is that
yeah.
he and you somehow are
it becomes
together.
Sort of like one.
Yes, exactly. And this, and then the whole discussion in Sufism is a very subtle one about how God can be the same and other at the same time.
Right.
And it can get, and this of course is where some theologians get upset, because especially in poetry, authors tend to be a bit over-exuberant about expressing their oneness with God.
Mm-hmm. Like Halaj, for example.
Yes. Well,
and Al-Haq,
yes.
and so on.
This sort of thing.
Now, somebody might say, or it comes to my mind as well, there are Muslims out there
yes.
who follow the Prophet,
right.
who act according to the Sunnah.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even to the extremes.
Yes.
Sometimes, you
right.
know. But they don't experience the love of God. I
right.
mean, for example, when I love somebody, I love a human being, that person loves me back, I experience that love probably in them missing me or calling me or what have you. What are the signs of being loved by God?
Well, I think it's, we've all of us, most of us at least, have been in love.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you know what it's like. It's something very, very special.
Mm.
It cannot be expressed. Ask Maulana. I mean, over and over again, he says, love cannot fit into words, we cannot discuss it, we can't talk about it. On the other side of his mouth, he says, if you ask me about love, I will talk to the end of time, you know, mm. this sort of thing.
Mm.
So it's both inexpressible, and it is, it just produces a profusion of expression.
Right.
It's suicide. So, I don't want to say it's reducible to feeling, to emotion, certainly not, because it has to be together with mutabat, following the
right.
sunnah, and observance of the practices. But you see, one of the issues here, which of course becomes very major in Sufism, is what exactly is the sunnah of the Prophet?
Yeah.
Now, the sunnah of the Prophet, yes, is, of course, there are plenty of activities. But is that the only sunnah of the Prophet? There's an internal sunnah of the Prophet as well.
Mm-hmm.
Attitudes. Ihsan,
uh-huh.
for example.
Right.
Now, ihsan is, yes, it's expressed in good works, but it's an internal attitude. Taqwa, for example.
Right.
Now, taqwa, which is, you know, inna akramakum indallahi atqakum, which basically says that taqwa is the greatest characteristic that would, you know, gives you nobility in the sight
right.
of God. Now, what exactly is that?
Mm-hmm.
You cannot define it in terms of works.
Right.
It's an internal thing. I mean, here's where Sufi psychology, because who are the psychologists? I would call it spiritual psychology.
Uh-huh.
Sufi sheikhs are not interested in abnormalities. Psychology today is always about, you know, abnormal
right.
psychology, basically. We're trying to bring people back into the norms of society, which are themselves are rather abnormal,
right.
if you ask me. But nonetheless, you know what it means. They deal with people who are upset, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sufism basically takes a healthy and wholesome person and tries to direct them indirectly towards perfection, spiritual perfection, to develop these internal characteristics, which the philosophers talk about in terms of virtues, and in terms of, Al-Ghazali, and then of course brings philosophy and Sufism together, and he has very extensive discussions of ethics and virtues as interior qualities, right? And Sufi literature in general, is especially early Sufism, is an expression of what these interior qualities mean. Because since they're interior, they're invisible.
Right.
And but how does one know that one is going in the right path to achieve them? This is a very subtle thing. And one can deceive oneself very easily.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back after this news break. Don't go away. Welcome back. In this exclusive interview, we are talking with Dr. William Chittick on his life and Islamic mysticism. Now, so could we say then that, for example, some people who consider themselves to be pious or following the Sunnah still have not experienced that love of God, maybe their focus might be on the sort of stereotypical or one-dimensional aspect of the Sunnah, basically the exterior aspect of the Sunnah?
And that's exactly what I was trying to say.
Yes.
You put it very nicely.
Now, you wrote another book, The Sufi Path of Knowledge.
Yes.
About the way of Ibn Arabi,
yes,
and the
Sufi
of Ibn Arabi. So on one hand, you have the Sufi path of love.
Right.
On the other hand, you have the Sufi path of
right.
knowledge. Now, what is the role of knowledge in esoterism?
Let me just say, first, that the reason I chose that title for the second book was simply for it to be a pair, you know, it'd be sort of complement the first book.
Uh-huh.
And by no means that I want to suggest that love doesn't play a role in the teachings of Ibn Arabi. But if you read Ibn Arabi, if you read Maulana, you read his Masamin, especially his Divan.
Yeah.
I mean, love, everything circles around love. Mm. It's the language of love. It's the language of lover and beloved. The language of the intoxication of love, of the madness of love. You see, if you know your Islamic worldview, your Islamic teachings, you can see how it's very firmly rooted in the Quran, in the Hadith. But it's not obvious to people who aren't familiar with the tradition. Now, and who can understand Maulana? Any native Persian speaker at that time could have listened to Maulana's poetry and basically followed it. Didn't even have to be literate.
Right.
Today, university students have a very difficult time, I'm talking in Iran,
right,
following Maulana, and the reason is because they're trained as doctors and engineers, and, you know, his history is basically from a Western point of view. All of the sciences, the official sciences in the schools are Western models, Western paradigms. The Islamic worldview is basically lost.
Uh-huh.
Now, this has to be recovered in order for you to see where Maulana is coming from. When you go over to Ibn Arabi, Ibn Arabi is an author who was not writing for the common people by any means. He was not writing for the fuqaha. He wasn't writing for the mutakallimun. He was writing for the most sophisticated scholars of Islam who were masters of all the fields.
Mm-hmm.
People who knew their Quran, who knew their hadith, who knew their tafsir, who knew their kalam, who knew falsafa, who knew Sufism. And then he presents in page after page after page, you know, he's one of the most prolific authors in Islamic history. He's not the most prolific, but in terms of maintaining, a constant level of profundity, he's certainly the most prolific.
Uh-huh.
Most people repeat themselves after a while. One of the wonders of Ibn Arabi, the thing which always draws me back to him, is that I can never read a new passage without being astounded.
Uh-huh.
It's something new. It's always, you know, another chapter. I never thought of that. And what is it? Where does Ibn Arabi begin? Always with the Quran. Recites, you know, gives a verse or two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a chapter heading
which is always misleading, because you think, you look at the chapter title and you think, oh, I know what this discussion is going to be about. It's never the way you think it's going to be. He quotes a Quranic verse, which may or may not be the one you thought would be appropriate. He quotes a hadith or two, and then he begins explaining. Now, he's drawing from fiqh, he's drawing from all the schools of thought. At the same time, he's totally, not totally, but there's an originality there, which is really astounding. Mm-hmm. It's just, for people who know their Islamic sciences and meet him for the first time, it's basically one of these situations where you read and say, but that's so obvious. Mm-hmm. Why didn't anyone ever tell me this?
Yeah.
You see, it's this kind of author. You keep on discovering yourself in him.
Uh-huh.
Something you've always known, but no one is...
uncovers it for you.
Yeah, no one has uncovered it for you. Mm-hmm. Now, so, look at the audience. Mawlana is talking to everyone. A philosopher, theologian, baker, street sweeper. If they're native Persian speakers, they'll follow him. They will gain.
Right.
Mawlana is talking to a very small group of scholars. Rabbi Ibn Arabi. Yeah, Ibn Arabi is talking to a very small group of scholars. Any scholar can appreciate Ibn Arabi, can get something out of Ibn Arabi, but to really get something out of Ibn Arabi, you have to work a long time on perfecting your Islamic sciences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, do the two meet? Knowledge and love. Because I've heard, for example, some people say Christianity, for example, is the path of love.
Right.
And Islam is the path of knowledge.
Yes.
And both the path of knowledge leads to the knowledge of God, and the path of love also leads to knowing God.
Right.
In Islam, do they meet, or are they two separate, parallel paths?
Right. Yes, of course. I think the old image of the mountain is a good one. They may begin in different places. You know, the call to the soul of beautiful poetry, which just listening to it, just the sound of it is intoxicating, especially when it's... And you see beauty there, and beauty attracts you. And beauty is Allahu Jamil, where you hibbul jamal, right? Beauty is that which is lovable. Look, the model is God is beautiful, and he loves beauty. So... when you love something, you're loving the beauty in it, because we're made in the image of God. And those qualities come to us from God, and therefore our love is directed at the beautiful. Now that, by loving the beauty, you're loving God, whether you know it or not. This is one of Mawlana's constant themes, that you think you're in love with this or that, but in fact you're in love with the divine attributes. So when you start looking into Mawlana, although the language is a language of love, it's firmly rooted in the Islamic sciences, in theology, in metaphysics, in philosophy, but he never expresses it in their language.
Right.
It's always the language of the people, it's the language of food, the language of the garden, the language of a party where they're drinking, and beautiful women, and singing. You know, this is the language. It's very attractive and beautiful, but the message is the same message you find over in Ibn Arabi, that... through love, you reach God. Ibn Arabi says the same thing, but he does stress is that in order to properly love God, you have to know God, or know what is knowable about God, and know what is unknowable about God.
I see.
And in order to do that in the most comprehensive and perfect way, one has to be thoroughly versed in the various approaches of Islamic learning. Yes.
Now, what is the difference between the love of God as expressed in Islam and love of God as expressed in Christianity?
That's a very difficult one to answer, and especially since I'm not, of course I'm familiar with Christianity and I've read, but I wouldn't consider myself, qualified really to make any kind of statement, other than vague generalities, but I would remind you that Christianity today is pretty much of a far cry from what Christianity used to be in the Middle Ages. There we have these very great theologians, many of whom were immersed in the sciences. Look at St. Thomas, after all. You read St. Thomas Aquinas, the Summa Theological. Where's the love? I mean, this is very, very sophisticated Aristotelian Christian theology, philosophy, you see? And you kind of have to search through him to find all this talk of loving. Of course it's there. Of course it's basic.
Right.
But it's also extremely theoretical, extremely
rigorous, based on
it has all the qualities that the bad qualities of knowledge.
Right.
Now, the good qualities of knowledge are that the more you know God, the more you love him.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, I would say that for both Ibn Arabi and Maulana, this holds true, that when one is in the path, by knowing God, by recognizing God, because it's more a matter of recognition than knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
Knowledge suggests, for example, you might be able to get the knowledge from the books. No, the books are there, but they're simply preparing the way. They're simply kind of polishing your soul, giving your soul some guidance.
Yes.
But look at the famous hadith, which also is very popular. I mean, it's probably not an authentic hadith, but it may be my Imam Ali. But it's very, very central, and of course there's plenty of basis for it in the Quran. Man arafa nafsa faqad arafa rabba, right? The person who, I would translate, who recognizes himself,
mm-hmm.
has recognized his Lord, rather mm-hmm. than who knows himself,
mm-hmm.
as knows his Lord, right? Because of recognition, notice that recognition is recognition.
Right.
And the basic message of Islam, I would say, on the level of Tawheed, is that Tawheed is not is innate to the human substance.
Mm.
Every human being is created with this knowledge of Tawheed. Mm. The role of the Prophet is not to teach Tawheed, it's to remind us of Tawheed.
Right.
It's the tazkir, reminder, the dhikr, right? The tazkir. Now this is all, why don't you remember? Why don't you think? Why don't you, wake up?
Right.
Now when you wake up, you recognize that everything is under the guidance of God.
Right.
Everything is a manifestation of the mercy of God, the power of God, the creative activity of God, etc. and so on. The Quran guides in this way by providing all the names of God,
mm-hmm.
each one of which establishes a unique relationship with God,
right.
in terms of a certain quality.
Yes.
So I have plenty of books in Islam by theologians as well as Sufis, on the most beautiful names of God. But what are they talking about? How each name establishes a relationship which can be understood in terms of Tawheed. Right? And there are many, many of these books. Al-Ghazali, I think, was like the 35th important person in Islam to write such a book. I mean, and of course there were others.
Mm-hmm. But it's very interesting. I mean, you have a book called The Self-Disclosure of God.
Yes.
Which brings me to the idea of Islamic or divine cosmology.
Yes.
Where we recognize God in our immersion in wujud.
Yes.
Could we say that one of the problems of modern society today is that their cosmology has gone astray, that man no longer can place himself in that
particular... Well, yes, the way I would put it is to say that modern cosmology doesn't even deserve the name cosmology.
Mm-hmm.
It's cosmography.
Mm-hmm.
It's and physical cosmography. And by physical, I don't mean the natural world. I mean the physical world. The physical world is the world which is perceived by physics. And physics is a mathematical language.
Right.
The world that can be described through mathematics. But that's not the world we see. Listen to the physicists. Are they talking about any world you've ever observed?
Right.
No, it's all these mathematical things. Now, cosmos in Islam, alam, right? The world, jahan, kehan, I mean, many words. What's the basic definition? Everything other than God. You have God, you have everything else.
Right.
Everything else is called cosmos. Now, what does everything else include? Well, the Quran is very clear. We have the invisible realm, we have the visible realm. We have heaven, we have earth, and we have everything in between. So you have three basic worlds. And of course, in the ancient world, this is everywhere. Heaven as the world of the angelic beings, earth as our realm, and the intermediate realm as the place of the interpenetration of the two worlds,
mm-hmm.
where one can rise up into the spiritual realm, and where the spiritual realm can descend into. And then, anyway, so we have this, a very, very clear Quranic cosmology. You mentioned in our previous discussion, Before we began, you mentioned the book of Sachiko Murata about, you know, the Tao of Islam. And of course, that is probably, I think, the best book on Islamic cosmology. That is the contents of the Islamic worldview. How we can understand God, the world, and the human soul as basically one complete totality, each one of which is interrelated with the other in very specific ways. Even though that book focuses on gender relationships, since gender is rooted in the relationship between God and the universe first, God and cosmos, and second, in the relationship between the higher and the lower, heaven and the earth, the yang and the yin, you know, the language she uses to, for the basic theoretical structure is Chinese. So what Islam, what Islamic cosmology presents you with is a description of the whole cosmos, everything other than God, of which the physical cosmos, first of all, there is no physical cosmos because physics is not part of, you know, it's one of the least of the tools. There is, of course, an astronomy, which is very mathematical, among, you know, as part of Islamic cosmology. But the angels are very much present in Islamic cosmology. You have to be able to explain what kind of beings are angels.
Right.
This is part of cosmology. You have to be able to explain, and this is what the cosmologists are especially interested in, is what they call, on the philosophical side, mabda wa ma'ad, right? The origin, that is the whole, the appearance of the universe from God,
right,
and the return. That is the return of the universe, and more specifically, human beings, because that's the real issue, how we return to God by replicating our entrance into the world. We were created by God. We came down not all at once, but by stages.
Right.
You don't have to make them temporal stages. They're intellectual stages. They're metaphysical stages. They're cosmological. They're stages of causality. Mm-hmm. Which may have nothing to, you know, we're not talking time here, and we're talking other dimensions of wujud, the word you use, being, existence. Existence and being, in which became, you know, early on, with Avicenna, it became the basic word to talk about reality per se, including God and cosmos. We have to be able to explain how the necessary being, which that is God, whom a necessary being, that which is and cannot not be, and the possible being, which is the cosmos,
right,
which may or may not be, depending upon, you know, God, how these two relate. So that word, once it enters with Avicenna, I mean, it's there before him, but with him it becomes central. Then from then on, you know, Al-Ghazali is talking, everyone's talking about it.
Right.
Theologians use it as a standard term. Sufism certainly uses it. Ibn Arabi is famous for using it.
Recently, I read that Muslims wanted to create some kind of dialogue with the Roman Catholic Church.
Yes.
And on the side of the Roman Catholic Church, it was saying, well, look, we can't have a dialogue until you abandon or don't take too seriously your idea that the Quran is the unchanged and unchangeable word of God.
Right.
You know,
right.
And this brings me into the problem of the exoteric aspects of religion,
right. Yes.
Being somewhat not conducive, really, to interfaith dialogue and a mutual understanding between the religions.
Yes.
Now, does esotericism have that problem? What role does esotericism play, or can esotericism play, in fostering greater understanding between religions and understanding among mankind in general?
Well, let me say first that I'm not very comfortable with the word esotericism. I don't use it in my writings, except to say, well, some people speak of Sufism in terms of Islamic esotericism, because the use of the words kind of suggests that this is something not quite mainstream.
I see.
It ignores you know, it's kind of the common people out there, and they don't understand, but there's an elite there which does understand, and that's somehow they're the esoteric and they're the sophisticated, and the elite, exactly. Whereas I much prefer to use the word Sufism, which doesn't have any baggage, except that people don't know what it is if they hear it for the first time. Of course, among Muslims, it does have baggage. Mm. But I, after all, my basic audience is the West, or Muslims who are sophisticated enough to realize that it's a complicated issue.
You know, not to break into your conversation, but this brings up the question, in the Muslim world, for example, in Iran,
yes,
some people have a problem with Sufism.
Oh, absolutely.
They use the word Irfan.
Yes.
Is it justified?
Well, this has everything to do with the historical situation of Iran, especially during the Safavid period, and the Safavid is coming to power, and the Zarat, which began as a Sufi order, of course, the
right.
Safavids, and their attack on other Sufi orders, and and all sorts of things happened. But what basically did happen is that in order to continue talking about the important issues such as love for God, such as spirituality generally, to use an English word, you had to resort to another term. We're not talking about Sufism. That's this popular religion which is, you know, left to the boundaries of proper Orthodox Islam. We're talking about Irfan, which is this recognition of God, basically. Mm. The proper understanding of God. And so the Muslim thinkers were able to bring this back into mainstream Islamic thought simply by using a different word.
I see.
But otherwise, the basic discussions, and Sufism itself is a problematic word, of course, historically. Carl Ernst has a wonderful book, The Shambhala Guide to Sufism, in which he explains how Sufism itself came to be chosen by Orientalists. Anyway, that's a different discussion. But let me get back to this issue of esotericism, or spirituality, perhaps. If we limit ourselves to the level of either practice or orthodoxy, that is, right doctrine, right speech, then we're going to be caught up in arguing, you know, how exactly one has to act. And of course, what are the proper rituals before God, the rules and regulations, the ethical principles, or on the level of orthodoxy, what is exactly it means to say that God is one, you know, and then the Christians, you know, are accused by Muslims of saying that God is three, and this sort of thing. You get into all these issues.
Right.
Whereas, if you take another approach, which is might be referred to as esotericism, but the basic Sufi approach is to say, listen, all of these discussions, the purpose of practice is simply to put your soul into a receptive situation, model on the emulation of the Prophet. And of course, the Prophet continued to follow that same sun until the end of his life. To put the soul in the proper receptivity, in terms of practice, the body, as it were, and everything having to do with the body, thinking in the proper perspective by giving us the key points in which we have to relate our thinking. But the purpose is to bring about an inner transformation in which nearness to God is achieved. And at the level of that one does make some progress, it becomes clear that doctrinal expressions are really secondary. The details of practice and of ethics are unique to each religion. But the Quran itself repeatedly says that the message of each prophet is unique to the prophet. Mm. We never sent a messenger except in the language of his own people.
Right.
Every prophet was sent with the message, La ilaha illa ana fa'buduni. Mm. Right? There is no God but I, so worship me. Now, there is no God but I is simply the formula of Tawheed.
Right?
No God but God. That's Tawheed. Mm-hmm. The kalimat of Tawheed. So, all prophets, beginning with Adam, share the message of Tawheed and Abada, worship. But each prophet was given a special way of worship, a minhaj and a shir'a, the Quran calls it, minhaj and shir. A special way.
Mm-hmm.
Unique. Moses has a way. Jesus has a way. And then people get in discussion, well, Christians are no longer following it the right way. And this is all secondary. And I think my reaction is, who are Muslims to judge?
Mm-hmm.
The Quran is really quite ambiguous about this. Sure, it criticizes Christians and Jews for betraying the message of the prophets and some Christians and Jews. It doesn't make a general,
right,
you know, condemnations of all Christians and Jews. So, and certainly Muslims have to accept that Muslims themselves deserve to be condemned for not following the prophet properly.
Right.
You know, so they're in the same situation as Christians and Jews. So let's not argue about that, but argue, what is the goal of this? A kind of transformation of the soul, a kind of nearness to God. Can we talk about nearness to God in a language which Muslims and Christians and Jews and Hindus all understand? And I think we really can. And here we enter into the, of course, love becomes a very central issue here.
Right.
You can see how love in this whole discussion of nearness in Islam is, you know, qurba kana illa Allah, one worships for the sake of gaining nearness to God, how that's discussed in the Quran and in the Hadith letter in terms of love very often, and the mutual love of God and man, and how they come together by conformity to the way of God. And this coming together of man and God, on the level of the Sufi tradition, is very, very easy to discuss. And if you talk on the fiqh level, it's impossible.
Mm.
And kalam has, as I pointed out very, you know, earlier,
right,
has a very difficult time trying to reconcile
this. Because they emphasize the transcendent
side, yes, and forget all about the other side. He's with you wherever you are.
Right.
Right? He's all, you know, nearer than the jugular vein. And there are plenty of verses. Wherever you look, there's the face of God.
Mm-hmm.
These sorts of things. They forget about all those verses or interpret them in a way which turn them into statements of transcendence.
So what you're saying is that people avoid the essentiality, the essential,
yes,
aspects, and focus on the tools, basically.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
And not look at their goal.
That's,
I want to thank you very much for a very enlightening and profound discussion. And I hope we had, you know, 30 more days to keep on like this. But hopefully,
some other time, inshallah.
Hopefully, some other time, inshallah.
Yes, right.
I want to thank Dr. William Chittick for joining us here on Minbar. If you have any questions, comments, criticisms, please don't forget to write us at minbar@presstv.ir. That's minbar@presstv.ir. And until next week, we'll see you same time, same channel on Minbar.